Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/spoken today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You're right, mate. We're told to check in on our friends. No. Are you really okay? But there's a mental health crisis in this country. And asking our friends if they're okay seems as futile as placing a band-aid on a gaping wound. NHS waiting lists, a housing crisis, a broken social contract, systemic problems are being offered individualised solutions. It's Mental Health Awareness Week, and I spoke to journalist George Monbiot, who argues the root of mental health crises can be found in neoliberalism, the ideology that orders our life, as detailed in his new book, The Invisible Doctrine. Enjoy.
Am I tough enough?
Strong and stable leadership.
Total rhubarb.
Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Shut the fridge.
Not another one.
It's the Politics Show cast.
George Monbiot, hello. How's it going?
Great, yeah. Great to see you.
Great to see you too. Very glad you're here. Welcome back to the Politics Show basement. And congratulations, published day as well.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a bit scary. But, yeah.
But something to celebrate, no less.
Yeah.
The Invisible Doctrine. By yourself and Peter Hutchison, out today. And we're going to talk about neoliberalism. We're going to talk about mental health, well-being. But before we get into matters of such importance, for people unfamiliar perhaps with your work or who you are, tell us what you do.
I'm a journalist and activist, professional troublemaker, or so I'm told. I've been in this business for 39 years now, amazingly. And have failed at just about everything. So well's even more shit than it was when I started.
Great work. Yeah, well done. Something to be proud of. Let's start with mental well-being then. Let's get into it. I mean, in terms of by global comparison, I think there's only really one other country that pips us in terms of how poor mental well-being is,
yeah.
And that I believe is Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
According
yeah.
to the Global
so
Mind Project.
So we beat Uzbekistan. Yeah.
Good. Good stuff.
As we knock them into last place.
Wonderful.
So, a survey of 71 countries, yeah. And we are second to bottom on mental well-being, overall mental health.
And that, people might find that not particularly surprising, perhaps, but I would suggest that when you combine a statistic like that with the level of economic development that exists in a country like Britain, you kind of go, well, if we're talking about material gains in terms of GDP, maybe actually not standards of living anymore, but certainly from a historical perspective, you know, peace dividend, etc. What on earth is going on? What do you see driving this?
The things we were told would make us happy, but what's happened through the past 45 years is that we've been living under this system which tells us that we are alone, effectively. You're a consumer. You're not a citizen anymore. You're a consumer. And you're sitting at home and you're making your economic choices. You don't really have any political power anymore. You don't really have any psychological power anymore. There's no such thing as society, just men and women in their families, as Margaret Thatcher said. And we are being good little citizens, good little consumers, obedient, unthreatening to power, disconnected from each other, and we're falling apart. And the thing is that social solidarity is essential to mental well-being. We stand together or we fall apart mentally. And social solidarity has been smashed in this country. And it's been smashed quite deliberately, because from Thatcher onwards, the program was to atomize and rule. Yeah, when she said there is no such thing as society, that was a manifesto. That's how she wanted it to be, because there is such a thing as society. But you can basically destroy it. And she said, you know, the purpose of economics is to change the heart and the soul. And she did that. And tragically, subsequent governments have sustained her program. You know, she saw Tony Blair as her greatest legacy. Tony Blair saw her as perhaps his greatest influence. And it just continues and it grinds down our minds. That separation from each other, that sense that we're not all in it together, that sense that we're now an us and them society, and that the us has to be suppressed perpetually. If we step out of line, if we protest, if we do anything a bit different, we're immediately demonized, attacked, perhaps prosecuted. We're frightened and we're alone. So is it any wonder that we've got a mental health crisis?
Well, you'd probably have to say no, wouldn't you? And I would love, we will talk more about that, the sort of the sovereign individual and the consequences of that when it comes to questions about well-being. But I would just like to probe further this point about the kind of the uniqueness of the UK's position there, because yes, okay, Margaret Thatcher wasn't the president of France, but equally you would think you'd be able to say, well, the economic consensus broadly, there is a degree of alignment between these nations. What is it that's different about the UK?
And it's true that this sort of overarching ideology called neoliberalism has spread around the world. You know, it has affected every country, but the UK was its principal laboratory in the rich world. It's where in the rich world it kicked off in 1979. In poorer nations like Indonesia and Chile, it had already got going through coups, through military force. But this was the first country where it was done through a nominally democratic system. And part of the purpose of neoliberalism is to individuate blame. The individual is to blame for their circumstances, or is to be credited with their circumstances. If you're rich, it's all down to your hard work and enterprise. Never mind that you were born rich. Never mind that you got advantages of class, of colour, of whatever it might be.
A small loan from your father, perhaps.
Well, exactly. It's entirely down to you. You know, and so, like Donald Trump is like the epitome of this, you know, the self-attribution fallacy. I did all this myself. Yeah, apart from the couple of billion you got from your dad. But if you're poor, it's also internalized. You're to blame for being poor. It's because you're feckless. It's because you're unenterprising. If your kid is fat, it's because you're a bad parent. Not that we've got this obesogenic industry, these corporations, which are the vectors of obesity, pushing junk food at us. Not because the school playing fields have been sold off for development by government. No, it's your fault, and the blame is drilled into us all the time until we come to believe it. We internalize it and you think, yeah, I really am a shit person. I'm a useless person. And that, in combination with what I was discussing before, that atomization of society is devastating to our psyches.
Yeah, I think that Mark Fisher writes about that, right? Capitalist realism, the sort of the ennui, the fatigue that sets in, and how politically corrosive that is, because if you can destroy people's imagination, if you can destroy the capacity to imagine a better world, a better future, you essentially destroy your political opposition.
Yeah.
In terms of younger people in our society, because certainly here in the UK, if we're looking at sort of the density, frequency, severity, actually, of mental health issues, we do see a higher degree of pronouncement in that younger population.
Yeah.
And much of the rhetoric around it is very similar to what you've just described, basically. You know, your generation is soft. You know, you didn't have to go through rationing, whatever it is. You take your pick of the excuses. And if we do actually apply that structural critique, if we reject the idea that the individual is responsible, and we go, okay, so what is the system that the young person is now going into? Mm-hmm. Is it an insecure labour market? Yes, it is. I would go further than saying it's insecure. I would say it's a broken housing market. Mm. You know, in terms of the classic things a society typically promises its citizens, improvement of life, better standard of living. We've essentially broken those promises. I don't think it's surprising that we then look at them and go, well, they're depressed and they're anxious.
Well, as a young person, you're just bait now. Mm. You are just a profit-making unit which can be moved around and exchanged and extracted from. So you extract rent from housing. You extract rent in the form of interest payments for your student loan. You extract labor in the most fragmented and undermined sense, so that, you know, young people have got no labor security at all. And you effectively trade young people as if they were units. And this reaches its apogee in children in care and young people in care, because they are now tradable. A young person in care changes hands amongst private equity and sovereign wealth funds for £100,000. That's what they're now worth, because each of them represents a profit of £910 a week on average to one of these corporations. And these corporations have fixed the system so that it can't be reformed, in effect, because they lobby against any reform of the system. Everyone knows what's wrong with it. Everyone knows that it's in total chaos, that it's bankrupting local authorities. Local authorities, because they can't set up their own provision, are having to make emergency spot purchases of provision from these private equity companies, these venture capitalists, these sovereign wealth funds, at enormous, outrageous prices. Their business model is based on building or renting houses in the cheapest parts of the country. And then when a local authority puts out a market demand saying we've got a child needs care, say, yeah, we can provide that place, which means the child could be moved hundreds of miles from their home, breaking all their bonds with family, with friends, with teachers, with everything that might give them any sense of trust and belonging. So they're uprooted purely in order to serve this corporate machine. It's not in the benefits of the child. Not in the benefits of public finances. It's just in the benefits of profit making. And these companies are making 20% a year. That on average, that's their average profit. It's a stupendous level of profit from these tradable assets called children in care. So yeah, that's the extreme end of it. But there's a whole spectrum of young people being exploited in ways which sort of end up with that logical extreme.
So tell me more about that kind of break. The most striking part of that to me was the relocation, right? Hundreds of miles, you end up disconnected, disassociated almost. Yeah. Particularly in a broader societal context in which the proliferation of digital technology means that our day-to-day interaction, whether it's just conversation face-to-face, spending time with each other, particularly, again, I'm speaking from a younger perspective here, but we've outsourced a great deal of that to these ginormous digital corporations. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the consequences of that for social fracturing, social atomization.
So when social media came along, I thought this was the best thing that's ever happened to us. Because I thought, A, we can break the stranglehold of the mainstream media, which was essential, because most of our mainstream media is owned by offshore billionaires whose interests are the polar opposite of ours, but they spend their whole time trying to persuade us that what's good for them is good for us. But also, it's going to bring us together into bigger and more powerful citizens' movements than we've ever seen before. You know, you look back at history and you look at the Levellers' revolts or the Diggers' revolts in the 1640s, and you think, if only they had social media, they could have all risen up at the same time instead of being picked off one by one.
Distributed by the new model on Twitter,
army.
Yeah.
That's right, exactly. And that was what I thought social media was going to deliver. But of course, as usual, I was naive about these things. And it's taken over or created by billionaires who, again, have got the opposite interests to ours. And it's just another form of predatory exploitation. And of course, it fits very well with the neoliberal ideas of constant competition and comparison. He's got more likes than me, more friends than me. You know, you're just always comparing yourself, A, to other people, but B, to a sort of transcendental form of yourself that you can never aspire to. So, you know, you've got all this sort of digital manipulation, which can make you look so much more beautiful than you really are. And that's the image that you present. But of course, you can never live up to your own image. So you end up consuming yourself, competing with yourself. And on top of everything else, I mean, I don't think it's a root cause, but I think it exacerbates all these other tendencies that we're talking about. It just breaks your mind down.
I think, because when I talk about this, I think on the one hand, right, it could and has, I think, still has the possibility to be actually quite a democratizing force, right? Mm. You know, whether it's, I don't think the Arab Spring is necessarily the best example of these powerful, all-encompassing change-making revolutions.
They made a good start.
They got there. They started getting towards it, right? But, you know, the face has changed, the regime stays the same. Yeah. But, I don't know, school climate strikes or Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
Particularly actually in the wake of George Floyd and the way the sort of the global reach of that execution.
Okay.
It isn't as simple for me as saying, you know, that this is a net negative. I think there are clear, whether it's civic engagement, direct democracy initiatives, participatory budgeting could be an idea, for example. And that actually, if we were to, I think, challenge the kind of the power bases, the concentration of power and capital that own these companies, there is a model there that could be useful and enrich our society.
It's a set of tremendously useful tools, which if they were not in the hands of billionaires, but they were in our hands, if social media were controlled by cooperatives, if it was a commons, in other words, owned by the community that uses it, that would be the most powerful commons that humankind has ever invented.
Mm.
And we could do amazing things with it, not least transforming democracy. Because digital tools give us the opportunity to intervene in decision-making every day, whenever we want to be permanently politically active citizens shaping the decisions that shape our lives. And instead, we have this 18th century system. I mean, it's quite amazing that in the 21st century, we should still be laboring under this system where every 5 years, the parties put themselves forward for election. They publish a manifesto with several hundred items in it, which nobody reads. And then they campaign on the basis of one or two of those, or even on a three-word slogan, get Brexit done. The party with the most votes then gets into office, even if it's got a minority of the total vote, and assumes a mandate for everything that was in the manifesto, plus everything that wasn't in the manifesto, that it can get through a parliament for the next 5 years. It presumes consent for its entire programme.
Mm.
We don't accept the principle of presumed consent in sex. Why should it be accepted in politics?
It's a powerful point. Really powerful point. We've covered the doctrine aspect, I think. Tell me more about the invisible part of this. What makes this ideology? We're pointing at multiple examples here. Yeah. I mean, how invisible is it?
Yeah, well, that's the amazing thing. We can say, oh, this is going wrong, and that's going wrong, and oh, yeah, and all those other things are going, and we don't connect them. We don't see that it's all part of the same doctrine. And it's a doctrine with a name, or it used to have a name, neoliberalism. That's what they called it. In 1938, the people who promoted this doctrine came up with this new term, neoliberalism. It's not a very good word for it, but that's the word they gave it. And it was a very different doctrine to the prevailing ones at the time. Many people thought it was absolutely disgusting and outrageous. They were horrified by it. Except very rich people thought it was the best thing they ever come across because, this is everything we want. Fantastic. Rip down taxation, rip down redistribution, rip down regulation, rip down public services, rip down the economic safety net, destroy trade unions, destroy protest, effectively destroy political choice, and just have this thing called the market, which everyone is going to make their choices in the market. And through buying and selling, we will work out who the worthy people and the unworthy people are, because the worthy people will have the grace of the invisible hand bestowed upon them and will know who they are because they're rich. And the unworthy people will know who they are because they're poor. So the rich people loved this, but it was otherwise really, really unpopular. So it had to operate below the radar. And it had to build what's been described as a neoliberal international, a network of think tanks, of academic departments, of tame journalists, of tame government officials, who would quite secretly build this program, which they did very, very effectively. And you get these little glimpses from the odd autobiography and the odd incautious comment about how they did it. And we just weren't supposed to see this. And within a couple of decades, they dropped the name for it. And they the whole story they told us was, well, this is just the way things are. It's just a natural order. Humankind, we're just selfish and greedy, and that's a good thing. And the richer people at the top get, the richer everyone will get, because the wealth will trickle down. And if you're going against this natural order, you know, you're thwarting the way that human beings should be. And so by getting rid of the name and not replacing it with any other name, A, they left us totally confused, but B, they were able to create the impression that this wasn't an ideology at all, that there was nothing new about it, there was nothing odd about it, there was nothing outrageous about it, it's just the way things are. And so we end up with the extraordinary situation that an ideology that was as dominant, is as dominant as communism was in the Soviet Union, is unknown to most of the people in our society.
Can we talk about this in the context of our two main parties here in the UK, right? Because I've sort of made this point before and produced some sniggers, I think, when I was on the BBC and said it on Laura Kunzberg's show, that essentially, you know, the Thatcherite consensus has continued since the 80s. And there'll be people, you know, sort of, I don't know how to describe them, holders of acceptable thought, opinion makers, shall we say, who sort of say, well, how on earth can you look at the policy programmes of, let's say, the new Labour government, and at the time the Conservative Party that it was competing against? How can you look at David Cameron's Conservatives and Ed Miliband, for example, and say these two people have the same political platform? Are they people that argue in that way, are they missing the point that there is essentially a broad socioeconomic consensus that sits behind this and that we're just twiddling around the edges? Or am I kind of being simplistic and naive to suggest that, no, there's this whole scope of political thought that exists beyond the realms of this actually very narrow place that our electoral politics occupies?
Well, Ollie, I'll go for option one.
I thought you might, yeah.
Yeah. So if you take a look at the Tony Blair's government.
Yeah.
In opposition, they had promised to renationalise certain privatised public services, such as railways, for instance. They had also promised to bring prisons back into the public sector, which were being privatised, and a whole load of other things, which, you know, made them look pretty good. And you think, yeah, okay, we want that. That's great. Soon as they get into power, they drop those pledges and instantly start privatising more prisons.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's the Politics Show cast.
We've had Mariana Mazzucato in here, who's spoken at length about sort of how it's capitalism for the rich and essentially sort of statism, but I wouldn't say communism, but, you know, central planned economy for the state in that. Programs like that, essentially, you socialise the risk. It's not the fallacy of capitalism is like, you take the risk, you reap the profit. But in actual fact, what we're seeing with something like PFI or otherwise, or, you know, 2008 financial crash, okay, the capitalist response to that is always say, well, I'm afraid your bank is collapsing, but the game's the game. You know, yeah. Obviously it's not more reaching consequences, and there's, I think, not a world really where you could just allow the financial system to collapse. But nonetheless, you sort of go, well, yeah, we've been making it big for decades, and yes, you know, Gordon Brown, the bank is collapsing now, but you really have no choice but to bail us out. And thus, the risk is socialised.
Exactly.
They reap the profits.
Well, and this is particularly the case in public services, because a public service can never be allowed to collapse completely. There'd be a revolution. You know, if the NHS simply collapsed and hospitals just shut their doors, Yeah, people would be out on the streets despite all the protest laws. You couldn't put that back in its bottle.
There'd be some nuisance noise, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, there'd be some nuisance noise. And maybe some bad smells.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And so you have to bail it out. You know, however bad a public service gets, it can't be allowed just to fail completely. It can be allowed to get really, really bad, but not to completely collapse. And that means that the corporations can simply walk away. They can milk away enormous levels of profit. We're seeing this in the water industry at the moment. Yeah, they've extracted £72 billion in dividends since privatisation, most of which was extracted with the help of debt. So they loaded themselves up with debt, took the money out as dividends, and then left the debt in the system, knowing that one day they're going to collapse, and they just walk away from the debts, leaving the state not just a whole wodge of debt, but rivers full of sewage and a totally failing water supply system. You know, everything just literally going to shit.
Mm. Can we talk a little bit about, since you're talking about it, the waterways right now? I mean, there's been some headlines in the last couple of weeks about the Environment Agency planning to do these tests at a variety of different sites. I think there's about 400 different swimming locations around the country saying they're going to monitor for things like E. coli, other harmful bacteria, to assess whether these swimming spots are safe. I mean, beyond possibly being closing the barn door after the horse has bolted, is there a solution to this problem that doesn't include public ownership, doesn't include wholesale reform of the sector? I mean, I don't think I asked you about the waterways last time, so I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, when Mrs. Thatcher tried to justify water privatisation in 1989, she said, you know, you people on the Labour benches, you're just talking rubbish. You'll wait and see. You'll see what the outcomes are, and you'll see it'll be a much better system than it is at the moment. Now, in fairness to the water companies, you know, at least 90% of the water coming out of our taps is actually water. So, you know, triumph for privatisation. And some of the water flowing down the rivers is water as well.
Yes.
You know, so it's not a total failure.
Not a total failure.
The rivers seem strangely warm a lot of the time. But that's great for swimming, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
It is literally a shit show.
Yeah.
There's no other way of describing it. And it was bound to happen. And the thing is that, you know, people like Bob Cryer, this Labour MP at the time, were predicting exactly what was going to happen and describing it correctly as legalised theft from the public realm, because these invaluable assets were flogged off for a fraction of what they were really worth. And people made massive fortunes overnight who had bought up those assets and then dumped them. Now they're in the hands almost entirely of foreign capital, of the private equity companies, but also of sovereign capital. So we're in this extraordinary situation where the government has banned the Telegraph from being taken over by the United Arab Emirates, because the Telegraph is absolutely essential to our national character and identity and well-being, as we all know so well. But it's perfectly permissible, and indeed it has happened now. It is the case that UAE countries have taken over large parts of our water system and large parts of residential care for children in care as well. That's just fine. Perfectly acceptable.
Mm. The railways as well, great example, right? A lot of European powers owning the franchise. And
foreign states own our public services. It's hard to get your head around that. And this is the party of sovereignty. These are the people who are constantly going on about their patriotism, their love for the country. Britain comes first. We keep the foreigners out. You know, the people who most loudly proclaim their patriotism are always the first to sell us down the river.
Yeah, well, the Benite idea of sovereignty, right? The pen, the sword, and the purse. Yeah. And we've outsourced defence, the sword, to the Americans.
Yeah.
We've recently reclaimed our sovereignty from the EU over our lawmaking, and we've lost economic sovereignty in the sense that you're just describing. Yeah. To backtrack a little bit, and we were talking about the Labour Party, and I'm asking about Tony Blair, but I'm doing it with an eye to the conversation we will have about Keir Starmer and Labour in a moment's time, about whether or not an opposition party has ever been more radical in government than it was in opposition. Because what you described there with Labour was bold or radical ideas, but ideas like public ownership that get moderated in government, whether by the sort of the soft touch of the civil service, the reality of the situation they encounter when they actually sort of get under the bonnet and say, okay, this is how things are set up, how they work, or political imperative. And at the moment, there's this sort of dance going on where you're told, well, yes, you know, the Labour Party as it stands right now isn't promising the world because it would be irresponsible to do so. But just wait until they get into power. And then you'll see, you know, the power of reform, the power of the radical things that we're going to do. And I look at, for example, New Labour, and I go, well, the complete opposite is what you just described.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there is an example of an opposition party that once it gets into power is actually more radical than when it was in opposition.
If an opposition party wants to do radical things in power, it has to prepare people for that. It has to explain it. It has to lay out a clear program for radical change. If you just drop it on people without any preparation, then people will be horrified and won't know what to make of it. They won't understand it, and so they'll react against it. That's a simple move of politics. You have to prepare people. But also, if this story were correct, which very clearly is not, that suddenly when Keir Starmer's in office, the true radical Keir Starmer will emerge that none of us have so far been able to detect. If that were true, then his opposition, the Conservatives and others, would be able to say, in a perfectly reasonable way, well, this wasn't in the manifesto. You don't have a mandate to do any of this stuff. You know, if this wasn't the package that you sold to the public, and it wasn't anywhere in that package, and you suddenly land this on people after the election, well, then that's illegitimate. It doesn't even accord with our extremely weak and thin system that we call democracy.
The Leave conform to the bare minimum standards that we've set.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk about that more detail in a moment, but let's go back to the text, go back to the book. I mean, something you wrote about is how neoliberalism has kind of led to this loneliness epidemic. Could you talk about that in a little bit more detail?
So we are the ultra-social mammal, with the possible exception of the naked mole rat, which is technically a eusocial mammal, a bit like bees and wasps. But we'll put naked mole rats aside, and probably best not to talk naked mole rats. The expurgated version is that the human beings are the ultra-social mammal, who are more connected to each other than any other species, except naked mole rats. And that connection is absolutely essential to our well-being. Now, the neoliberal myth is that we're primarily selfish and greedy, right? And we haven't got a bit of selfishness and greed in us. You know, we can't deny that. The value surveys show that very clearly. But those are not, in the great majority of people, our dominant characteristics. Our dominant human characteristics are empathy, altruism, kindness towards others, family feeling, community feeling, wanting a better world. Not just for yourself, sure, for yourself, but also for other people. That really marks us out. And that is a very strong determinant of our humanity. But we've been persuaded all this time that we should be self-made men and women, as if such a thing were possible. It's a complete pipe dream that you could be such a thing. And that in order to become that thing, you must cut yourself off from other people. And that state of splendid isolation is something to aspire towards. And all the time, what we see in public life is that selfishness and greed being modelled, because those who dominate our societies are actually very different psychologically to most of the people in those societies. Broadly speaking, we're a society of altruists governed by psychopaths. And so, here we are in our little bubbles, being the good consumer / citizens we're supposed to be, the good subjects, put it that way, doing what we're meant to do, being consuming stuff in our own rooms, scrolling on social media, watching the telly, cut off from each other. And lo and behold, it has devastating effects on us. Who would have guessed?
And it reaches third spaces as well, right? It's sort of this war on, it might just be as simple as the pub. It could be, well, formerly it would have been a youth centre, you know, town hall, village hall, places like that. It sort of degrades on that public sphere, public realm as well.
And we're losing that civic life. That civic is a very old-fashioned term, civic life, civic society. People don't use it anymore, but actually it's a really important term because that's where our humanity is really best expressed, is in the places and the events for which we come together. You know, we come together, we meet each other, we make common cause, we connect. And you know, you can do so in quite a negative way. You know, you can have fascist marches, which is a very negative form of, you could call that a sort of bonding community where the same sort of people come together and they exclude difference. But you can also have your bridging community where very different people of different backgrounds and different experiences come together and form community. And, you know, millions of examples of doing that really successfully. But the sort of neoliberal effort is a war against that. It's an attempt constantly to thwart that coming together.
Is there a world in which you see work actually connecting to fixing this problem? It's very easy to kind of reduce it down to sort of economic activity, you know, the drudgery, drone work, etc. But is there a world in which meaningful, fulfilling work actually connects to a kind of reinvigorating, rejuvenation, improvement of these things that we're talking about here, civic society, for example?
Yeah. Well, first, let's not forget that the long-standing promise was that we were all going to be working much less.
Yes.
We'd be having much more interesting jobs, we'd be able to do away with drudgery, and we'd have a lot more leisure time.
Yes.
That almost every economist, like 50, 60 years ago, was predicting that was going to be the case. When you reach a certain level of wealth, we all have to work much less. Well, we've exceeded that level of wealth, and we're working like ants. We're working our asses off despite that, or because, you know, the neoliberal plan was never that you stop working.
Mm.
You become ever better drones for capitalists. and so, you know, yes, you know, you can absolutely, we should all aspire to fulfilling work, ideally much less of it, and many other fulfilling activities in our lives, but the kind of work which does make you more whole, which does give you a sense of utility and purpose, which we really need. Everyone needs to feel useful. That's a really important aspect of the human psyche. You want to know that what you're doing means something, will improve things, will make things better. Other people will benefit from it. People will see you positively for what you do. All of these things are very important to us. But for millions of people, that opportunity is being cut off with the gig economy, with all these models of making work insecure, with the sort of fake freelancing that we're forced into, with the lack of continuity in the workplace. You know, and I don't romanticize the sort of mass working environment we used to have, which could often be incredibly boring, very oppressive,
dangerous,
sexist, racist, dangerous, lots of bad stuff going on. But at least it did help to engender some forms of social solidarity, not the ideal form sometimes, but it helped. Now, you know, I've always been a bit suspicious of building our politics around the workplace because automatically very large numbers of people are going to be excluded from that. I mean, even at the height of industrialism in 19th century England, there were more people working in domestic service than there were in factories or mines. And of course, those people, being fairly isolated, were cut off from the labour movement. Of course, the labour movement was absolutely essential, but it could never be the be-all and end-all. It could never be the answer to all your problems because only some people, by definition, can be part of that movement. So I think we need to find our political roots in community, in the neighbourhood, an inclusive neighbourhood, you know, which brings together anyone who wants to join within that neighborhood, but investing in meaningful, participatory, deliberative democracy, starting at the neighborhood level, and participatory economies as well, based on the commons, local resources which we control, rather than allowing some private equity company based in the Cayman Islands to control, or some sovereign wealth fund in Abu Dhabi to control, that actually this is in our hands. And then we start to build something that we can belong to and that belongs to us.
I don't want to get back down the road of, we spoke last time roughly about kind of agrarian localism and these ideas, but, and so I would just direct viewers to that conversation if they want to see that those ideas discussed. But is a logical conclusion of the things that you're advocating for, so, you know, communitarian, local, would that end up sort of being the pretty radical idea of a kind of degrowth economic platform, right? That is, well, it is radical. It's certainly a departure from the orthodoxy. And it, in a way, that there are the people who say, you know, whether it's, I don't know, you know, 4-day week, 3-day bender, whether it's we produce our own food and it stays in the local community, whatever it is, it's still in a way is quite a, I won't say extreme, but it is a radical idea, isn't it? You'd have to say so.
Yeah. Look, we also need global action and global activism. Yeah, because we are facing global issues, like, you know, the distribution of food. Yeah, we can't do it. I mean, most countries can't do it all at home. It's just they simply don't have enough fertile land, enough water to do it. Climate breakdown is a global issue. Security, war and peace, these are global issues. You know, we can't just focus inward. We have to build outwards. And I'm very keen on some of the ideas of Murray Bookchin, the great social ecologist. He was himself a labor organizer, foundryman, who wrote some very powerful arguments in favor of building your national and ultimately your global politics from the neighborhood upwards. And into that you can incorporate degrowth, or rather the dethroning of growth. We're no longer dependent on growth to prevent economic collapse, which is currently what we are. You know, you shouldn't need to have perpetual growth to stop economic collapse from happening. You need to have an economic system which is robust, which can sustain itself without sucking in resources from all around the world, which basically growth depends on. It's a colonial model. I mean, this thing we call capitalism is basically colonial looting. You know, following the geographer Jason Moore, I think there's a very powerful argument for tracing it back to the island of Madeira in 1450, the roots of capitalism. That's where the first capitalist system was established. And that system then went on to take over the world. And from the very beginning, it was reliant on slavery, on ecological destruction, on the exhaustion of local resources, on highly exploitative relations, right the way along the chain, and then on quitting when you ran out of resources and moving to the next frontier, which was San Tome, and then the coast of Brazil, and then the Caribbean. And that was a new economic system. You know, people, one of the things which amazes me is that you see people on the telly who spend their lives defending capitalism. Well, it's the only system, there's no other way of doing it. And you think, they don't know what capitalism is. This is really weird. They're talking about a system and they obviously don't know what it is. And then on the other side, you see all these people say, oh, I hate capitalism, I'm anti-capitalism. I'm not quite sure you know what capitalism is either. You know, it's this very weird thing. We all talk about this thing without actually defining it. Mm. And when people do produce a definition, they say, well, sorry, that doesn't distinguish this economic system from A, all the alternatives that were around, and B, what was there before capitalism came along, which was also buying and selling, but in a very different social and cultural context and with very different constraints attached and with all its own oppressions and all the rest of it, but with very different social and ecological outcomes. This is was a new system in the 1450s, which has swept the world with devastating consequences. And what it's done is to enable a one-off exploitation of the world's most accessible resources. And now it's working its way down the entropic food chain. So in ecological ways, you can see this very clearly. You know, you'll start by targeting the big fish, the tuna, the marlin, the swordfish, the Patagonian toothfish, and then you go smaller and smaller and smaller until you're catching bait fish and then feeding them to farmed salmon to try and get back up the value chain. You can see it with timber. You know, they'll go in and take the mahogany, the ironwood, the rosewood, the pau brasil, and then they'll go for the less valuable species, and then they'll go right on down until they're turning all the rest into pulp, right? And this happens again and again. It happens in social terms as well. You know, they'll loot societies and take the most accessible resources in terms of labor, in terms of everything that people have built You're like, we build up the NHS and then they come in and they loot it. And they wheel off what they can from the NHS, and then they'll go for the next most valuable thing and the next most valuable thing. And they're just degrading the common stock of wealth, they're degrading natural wealth. And this is supposedly making us richer. It's not. You know, in terms of the wealth that counts, it's making us much poorer, even while it generates more GDP.
You mentioned potential economic collapse in that answer. So I'll make a reference to Liz Truss, which you write that she's kind of, her politics was almost the purest expression, perhaps, right, of neoliberalism, almost following it to the letter. And we saw the consequences of what that meant for our political economic system. And I'd like us to have the Starmer conversation now, and as we sort of come to the end of the interview, about how much you believe him to be a departure from said system, said ideology. If we say that it's defined British politics since Thatcher, how much do we view the likely next Labour government as representing a departure from that consensus?
Yeah, well, we shouldn't. We would just be disappointed if we didn't.
You'll only be let down.
You'll only be let down. I mean, yeah, in fairness, he's keeping us in our safe space of, lying, two-faced politicians who break every promise they make. And so, we feel a bit comfortable about that because that's what we're used to. Of course he's not breaking with that consensus because he knows where the discipline lies. And the discipline comes from the billionaire press, mostly owned by offshore billionaires. It comes from the corporate donors. It comes from the whole other infrastructure of corporate power. It comes from the junk tanks, these Tufton Street dark money think tanks. It comes from this whole panoply of persuasive tools which are used to tell people that if a government or political party steps out of line, we saw this with Corbyn, they are the devil incarnate and they must be destroyed. And he saw what happened. He saw what he had to do. He stands for election, stands for precious little else. And he knows that to have a chance of power, shot of power in this country, you have to do what you're told.
He made the speech today, right? Six first steps for a Labour government and the policy pledges they're going to go on. And this discussion, at least in the immediate aftermath, it was very recent, it was a couple of hours ago, right? But the sort of discussion has been, is it right to sort of assess him as an heir to Blair? Is it right to understand Starmerism? And I think there's still some pretty significant questions over what that actually means. But I saw there's a couple of pieces, actually, I think last week, one of the New Statesmen, maybe one on Unheard, trying to define it. And whether or not we can understand it as a departure from continuation of, and I guess in a way, it's a way of having a conversation about, to an extent, the connection between the two. How involved Tony Blair is in the Labour Party to this day, or certainly as a possible source of inspiration for Keir Starmer.
So there's a spectrum of possible politics, which is this wide, right?
Yeah.
There's a spectrum of acceptable politics, which is this wide. So sorry, I'm over here. This wide. Pretty close to the far right.
Yeah.
And it moves a little bit further over that way every year. And the savvy technocratic politician knows where they have to be if they're going to get into power. Blair knew that and Starmer knows that. And you have to be basically conservatism light. That is the test you need to pass if the people who really sort of make the big political calls, which are the newspapers, they are the BBC, they are the political donors, they are the infrastructure of economic power in this country. If they're going to allow you to pass without throwing everything they've got at you, and they've got a lot, they have a lot. They've got plenty of weapons of persuasion that they can use to make sure people don't vote for you and that you don't have a hope unless you're in that tiny spectrum. So when Mrs. Thatcher said there is no alternative, meaning there's no alternative to neoliberalism, in that case she was describing what has become the political reality in this country.
Can we understand that political reality, that window, that crevice, that crack of political electorally acceptable, electorally successful politics? Do we view that as a consequence of neoliberalism? How do the two connect to each other?
Sure. So what tends to happen is that a story dominates politics. And if you tell a persuasive story that is in the interests particularly of certain powerful factions, that story will come to be adopted by almost everyone. And the neoliberals very successfully and consciously told a powerful story. The world has been thrown into disorder by the overweening state, which crushes human freedom and drives us towards an eventual totalitarianism. It might look benign now, the welfare state, but you'll end up with Joe Stalin. That's the only way it's going to go. But the hero, who is the brave entrepreneur, will rise up against this oppressive state and against the odds will overthrow it, and by bringing back freedom and bringing back enterprise will restore harmony to the land. And that story captured the whole political spectrum, just as the Keynesian story, which used the same narrative structure but with the opposite message, did before it. I think it was Richard Nixon who said, we're all Keynesians now. Well, we're all neoliberals now. So in order to change this, we need to change the story. We need a new story. The only thing that can replace a story is a story. And this is what the left has spectacularly failed to deliver. This was why in 2008, when neoliberalism collapsed financially, it collapsed politically, it collapsed intellectually, it collapsed morally with the financial crisis it had caused, we stepped forward with nothing. And we ended up saying, well, maybe we should have a little bit less neoliberalism, or how about going back to Keynesianism? There's an idea. Yeah, as if you could go back, as if capitalism hadn't worked out how to destroy Keynesianism already, as if Keynesianism stimulating consumer demand was at all a relevant solution in an age of environmental crisis. Yeah, we have failed to produce a new story. We've got lots of great new ideas. We've got lots of great new policies. But it's like trying to weave a tapestry without a loom. You know, you've just got a whole pile of thread. And no one can see it. No one can see the picture. You need a story which says, this is where we are and where we stand and why we stand here. These are the people we oppose. These are the people who prevented us from having the better life we could have. These are the heroes, basically us. You know, we, the people coming together, the middle and working classes coming together, to reassert our sense of community, our sense of humanity, our amazing human capacities of empathy and altruism, rebuilding community, both political community, economic community, social community, rebuilding community to rebuild a new polity. We can overthrow, against the odds, these powerful and nefarious forces of neoliberalism and restore harmony to them.
George Monbiot, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Lee.
Very much so. Are you?
Yeah, a little bit.
Great work, guys. Happy days. That was brilliant, George.
Great. Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
You got some bits to clip. I wasn't ranting on too much.
No.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.